Alive, a 14-year-old from Doncaster has been found in London 5 days after she went missing with an older man. Officers spotted Lorna Vicarage with 35-year-old John Bush at Euston train station this afternoon. Both are said to be safe and well. In the last hour, Detective Chief Inspector Craig Robinson has updated reporters.
Mr. Bush has been arrested in London at Euston station, and at the time Lorna was with him. Lorna's now been taken into a safe place at a London police station.
The Prime Minister says Britain will continue to train and assist Syrian rebels, but has made no decision to arm them. President Obama has said America will offer the opposition forces more support because he's concluded chemical weapons have been used against them. The names of thousands of gun violence victims are being read out in Newtown, Connecticut. It's marking 6 months since 20 children and six adults were shot at Sandy Hook Elementary School. It's been revealed more than £1.7 million of taxpayers' cash has been spent on trying to get Abu Qatada removed from the UK. For around 8 years, the government has been trying to deport the radical cleric to Jordan. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
BCFM 93.2, the station you can...
Why wouldn't you want to...
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is the newly elected Green councillor for Ashley, that's around St Paul's area, Rob Telford. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, well done, concerned citizens. NATO's secret criminal elite Bilderberg conference was debated in the House of Commons for the first time ever this week. Minister without portfolio Ken Clark stood in for Chancellor George Osborne on Monday to defend his part in attending and organising last weekend's secret Bilderberg conference in Watford. And staying with Ken Clark, MP, his plans to hand over Britain's legal aid system, also now Justice Secretary Chris Grayling, to private firms G4S and Eddie Stobart Road Haulage were under scrutiny by the Justice Select Committee this week. Bristol barrister Michael Fitton was there and joins us to report back. Plus, the bee collapse syndrome is the story we ignore at our peril, and there's been more on bad news for the bees this week. Evidence too, as if we needed it, that genetically modified food is creating deformities in more than a quarter of the pigs that are fed it. So what will it be doing to us? Why does the government insist on pressing forward with this technology whilst refusing to force food companies to label GM food? Friends of the Earth are here to the rescue to at least help us make sense of bee collapse and the coalition government's taste for Frankenstein food. Plus, the former Chief Constable of Cambridgeshire, Tom Lloyd, will be around if we have time. If not, we're doing drugs next week. Plus, Martin Summers will take us on a weekly tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 12 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs up to 16. Plenty of showers this weekend, though, but also some sunny spells in between them. Next week, highs of 20, wetter at the beginning of the week, sunnier from the midweek on to next weekend, 22nd and 23rd of June, highs up to 20, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And helping us review this week's news, as I said, is the newly elected Green councillor for Ashley, which is around the St Paul's area, Rob Telford. Hi, Rob, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. All right?
Fine, yeah. First of all, a little bit about yourself. What's your background before you became a councillor in St Paul's?
Well, I've worked for the past few years as a teaching assistant, so I've been involved in a state school. I've been doing a lot of work with autistic spectrum kids. But in terms of my political life, I've been very involved in the democratic reform movement. I've been doing a lot of stuff with the Yes to Fair Votes campaign, but then after that, also getting involved with some of the other campaigns that groups like Unlock Democracy and some of the other reform groups are getting involved in. So those are the things I've focused on, but I've also done a bit of transport campaigning, the Make First Fair stuff that came out earlier this year, you know, trying to get better deal for Bristol's passengers on the buses, so things like that. Yeah.
Are you actually a Bristolian yourself? Where were you brought up?
No. I should have gone into that to start with. I've brought up in Leicester, but I've moved around a bit. I went to university in Cardiff and lived in Manchester for a while. Came to Bristol about 5 years ago. Mainly to see what it's about, really. I think I came back from the States. I've been over there for a while and came back and thought I'd see what Bristol was about. A few people I knew lived there, so came down.
Yeah. What were you doing in the US?
Again, it was work with kids. I did summer camp there, amazingly. And it was a real experience, actually. It's completely, you know, completely different culture, you know, to go over to America in a way. I mean, they do things so differently. But doing that and then doing a bit of travelling, seeing the country.
And what do you put your victory in Ashley down to? Because it was John Rogers. I mean, he was a major character in the Liberal Democrat Party. He was their candidate for mayor. And yet you got in instead of him in Ashley Ward at the mayor local elections.
I put it down to a positive message that we put all the way through. We didn't slag off our opponents. Put it down to the fact that we worked hard from the start. We were knocking on doors from January onwards, so we were trying to get in touch with as many people as possible and talk to them about what we stood for as Greens and why we make pretty good councillors, we think.
What's the Green vision for Bristol then in 10 years' time? A Green influence on the city. Where's that going to take us?
From my perspective, I think the transport system is, I mean, everyone always talks about it, it is the thing that needs to be sorted out most urgently. People can't get around the city well, but also things like standing up for people against the coalition's cuts, finding ways to give people good public services in the city. I mean, I think that actually is going to become even more difficult in the next few years with, you know, more and more budget cuts in the council. So,
but what are you actually doing? Because first group, I mean, we're constantly hearing, oh, there's going to be a review into what they're doing. I think probably 3 years we've had people moaning about them, saying that their services aren't reliable enough, that the fares are far too high. We were discussing last week that first group is a larger entity. Their parent group has got a £2 billion debt that it managed to get through purchasing some dodgy company in the United States. So basically they're having their main priority servicing that debt and paying their shareholders. The last person down the line is the Bristol public. So what have you been able to do about that?
Well, I think that actually, yeah, you're right, that it needs sort of looking at the source of why that's the case, you know. I mean, we don't have a publicly run bus service. I mean, that's what we want. And to say that it's all First's fault, yeah, fair enough, it is, but we have to go beyond that and say how can we stop First from having a monopoly over the services? And the only way we can do that is to say let's bring Bristol into a sort of relationship with our transport system where we've actually got control over it, because at the moment we don't. It's large companies running huge profits, and you know, it's not going back to the people of Bristol because the bus prices aren't coming
but it's
back.
Not going to go back to the old way of doing things, the old Bristol Corporation buses. That's what you seem to be saying, and aren't you know it's all great talk, but there's no real possibility of this happening, surely?
I think there are more possibilities now. I'm not an advocate of the mayoral system, but I actually do think that offers us some opportunities, particularly with the other authorities, to get a bit more sort of strategic thinking around transport. Because I don't think the other authorities in the area have been properly, I don't know, they've not properly been brought into it. And I think the ITA that we need, the Integrated Transport Authority, that's sort of the main idea, I think. I think that if we don't try to think of it in that joined-up way, we're not going to get anywhere. And you're quite right to say that it is all talk, and any time anyone talks about transport in Bristol, it does seem we're talking at cross purposes, and everyone's talking about it and wanting to change it, but we don't actually have that strategic thinking. So, I guess that's what I'd say. I don't think I've really answered your question, sorry.
No, you haven't, but I mean, I think, you know, there's a dilemma here, isn't there, which is Bristol isn't really the master of its own fate. It's largely,
right,
these things are decided from Westminster. So, you know, what is the point of people voting for you when actually all you're doing there is talking about the things you'd like to see, the way you'd like things to be, but you've got no real power to change it?
Yeah. We don't have any. I mean, I think we're having more and more centralisation brought in under the guise of localism. You know, all of these different things that have been suggested in the last few years that the Tories have suggested, we haven't actually got any more powers, and it just needs to be hugely changed. I mean, if you look at Barcelona as a city, it keeps 50% of the tax revenue in its city boundaries. It doesn't send it back up off to its national government. In Britain, in the UK, in Britain, we use about 13-17% across the city. You know, that's the level of what we've got to do. We've got to change these things. The way we do that is to get more green representation, because we're the only ones who've consistently said that we want devolution of power. All of the other parties have just sort of like flip-flopped on it and not really said exactly what they want. We want to bring power back to Bristol, you know, in a big way.
Well, I know one thing you think you can do, whether you can or not is another question, is the supermarket levy, isn't it? Explain this. I mean, really, it's a sort of tax, isn't it, on Bristol supermarkets?
Yeah, I'll make no bones about that. I think it is a tax, but I think the supermarkets earn enough money and take enough profits away from ordinary people in Bristol for us to ask for some money back. And the money that comes back from it, we'll get 8.5%, an 8.5% levy will actually raise 1.6 million pounds for Bristol, and that could be ring fenced, and we can put that, you know, into a budget so that we can actually improve local business and give people back a little bit of the livelihood that's been taken away from them by some of the cuts that are happening.
But how likely is that to actually happen? Again, you know, I'm asking the same question.
As in my role as a councillor, I have to talk to people from the other parties all the time, so it's just getting that idea into their heads that this is something we can do and it will make a huge difference to people's lives. And yeah, I agree that it's really difficult to get that done, but we've got to try. We've got to try and actually get a bit more influence in the council and get a bit more sort of influence with the mayor. And I think, you know, I think we've come to a point in Bristol, I think, now where people are starting to look at different ideas and start to look at different ways of doing things. And yeah, it does need to come back to large scale campaigns that people can subscribe to, and largely people agree with this idea that we should take a bit of money off the supermarkets and give it back. So if we can get some public support, but also, you know, to keep up the pressure, but also, you know, talk to the mayor, talk to the councils, I think we can do something with this.
Yeah, what about the whole relationship between the individual parties in the city and the mayor? Because you're saying, oh, we want to have a bit of influence with the mayor. It's almost like you're sort of tugging at his coattails, saying, oh, please, George, please will you listen? But actually, he's going to do his own thing. And, you know, there is an argument to say what you should be doing is really making your voice heard away from that deal with being in the cabinet, because of course Gus Hoyt is one of the members of the cabinet from the Green Party. Are you happy with the idea of being in the mayor's cabinet when actually all you can really do, again, is talk? It's the mayor that makes all the decisions.
I don't actually accept that, Tony. I think if you go into the cabinet, It isn't a statement about your belief in the mayor or whatever you think about the mayor. It is actually a position of influence. You can actually, you know, you can actually have some say over the city. And Gus does have that position. He does actually have a lot of say over what the mayor is doing. And you know, we made the decision in the Bristol Green Party democratically to go into that cabinet position. And you know, there were a lot of people saying we shouldn't even be considering it in the party. But eventually, we got to the position where the consensus came out that people thought, actually, yeah, this is a great opportunity. We can actually influence how the city's run. And Gus has got the, you know, environment and communities portfolio, so he's actually got influence over some of the things that we've always talked about for the first time, really. So
you just mentioned consensus there. That's one way to reach a decision. Not the easiest way in the world. Most political parties take votes, and then they don't even actually take any notice of the vote once it's been taken, like the Lib Dems with the secret courts, for example. Tell us a little bit about how the Green Party works. Do you always try and reach a consensus, and then if you can't take a vote, how does it actually function in the city?
Yeah, I think we've got quite a different approach. I mean, when we have a sort of citywide meeting, we sit down and we actually take a moment at the start to actually clear our heads, in a sense, of the business of the day, actually realise that this is something we need to come to together. It's not something we can just sort of like rant at each other about. And I do think there's always that tension in other political parties, but in the Green Party we do always seek to find a communal way, not necessarily what one individual wants to dominate proceedings and sort of say things. So that's
I'm saying, as opposed to a way of voting, you know, do you actually take votes, or do you usually reach a decision?
We sometimes take votes if it's something that is very contentious, yeah, but most of the time we tend to get to a point where everyone has sort of had their say and everyone sort of realises where the conversation has gone. I think there needs to be more of that in politics. And actually, I already, only having done one council meeting, full council meeting in Bristol, I already feel like there's a huge division between me and, you know, members from the other three parties, because of where we're sitting. And it seems ridiculous to me that we can't, oh goodness, just, you know, like, why can't we just all get along? I mean, I know that's very hippie, but at the same time, it's a truth, you know. A lot of the time, outside the council chamber, we get along with each other really well. I get along with people from all parties. But yet, when we get into that council chamber, it starts becoming a shouting match.
So why is that?
It's because people have ambition and they're getting ambition to get further on their party, to get seen as this great crusader for the truth or whatever, you know. So
what about vested interests? And I mean, are you talking about within, say, for example, the Liberal Democrat group, within the wider Liberal Democrat party outside? So people are looking at possibly, you know, moving up through the Lib Dem party nationally, and that they're concentrating on those kind of priorities rather than the city's priorities.
Yeah, undoubtedly. I think as a Green politician, you're never in it for doing that, because you realise that that's actually a much longer term vision, you know, a longer term aim. I think we all acknowledge that, and that's why I joined the Green Party, because I knew that I could just say exactly what I thought, and it usually coheres with what the Green Party policy is. But yeah, no, I do think that people use it for that. But I think that will be less of an influence now we have a mayor, actually, because people will be less able to get those positions of influence. I mean, you can't become a cabinet, the council leader now without being elected. So it has changed things in that sense, yeah. And I think there are a lot of politicians in Bristol who are ambitious, and it is personal ambition. It's not to do with the ambition of the city. And hopefully I won't get that way.
Okay, Rob. Well, we're going to hear from old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers after we dipped into Wednesday's Prime Minister's questions, because there was a little bit of a tete-a-tete between Prime Minister David Cameron and the Leader of the Opposition, Ed Miliband, over the latest employment figures.
Figures do show some increase in wages, but obviously real wages have been under huge pressure ever since the calamitous boom and bust on which he presided. But what is good for people is that under this government we're cutting their income tax this year.
Mr. Speaker, he's into his fourth year as Prime Minister, and his excuse for falling living standards is, don't blame me, I'm only the Prime Minister. It's simply not good enough. And he doesn't understand that because of his failure to get growth in the economy, wages are falling for ordinary people. He wants to tell them they're better off, but actually they're worse off.
Well, actually, Martin, the figures are that there's been a fall in unemployment. The jobless total in 3 months to April has gone down to 2.51 million, while the number of people in work has risen 24,000 in the same period.
Yes, I mean, economists are trying to work out what's different about this recession, or depression, if we can call it that, from the 1980s. And, of course, in the 1980s, wages were sticky downwards, in the sense that trade unions were still relatively strong, even compared to now. And, basically, people couldn't have their real wages cut. And that meant that all the weight of the deflation was pushed onto unemployment. So people lost their jobs and were put onto unemployment benefit. And if they couldn't survive on unemployment benefit, they were then put on a sickness benefit. What we've got now is a situation where the bosses have got the whip hand, and they're actually able to force people's wages down, and people have to swallow it, because it's that or lose your job. But of course, the overall macroeconomics of that is that the demand in the economy is being squeezed out. So people are in work, but they're still being paid money, because of course, working tax credit for many people on low incomes is actually a subsidy. So even when they're in work, they're still basically being subsidised by the government. And we've got a situation where demand in the economy is draining away. And if demand in the economy drains away, eventually there's going to be a crash.
Well, there has been a change in the way unemployment's measured, funnily enough. It's now just the number of people claiming job seekers allowance. But, I mean, how does that enable the figures to be massaged? I think there's always pressure on the government to deliver the figures that people want to hear.
There are two main ways of measuring unemployment. One is who's claiming unemployment benefit, which always used to be the way, but since there have been so many changes in who's entitled to unemployment benefit over the years, you can't make comparisons. So the other way of doing it is through Labour Force Survey, which is the international method of doing it, which can make comparisons between countries. That's essentially like an opinion poll. So they go out and ask, you know, a representative bunch of people whether they're A, working, or B, if they're unemployed, if they've looked for work in the last 3 weeks. And if they've looked for work in the last 3 weeks, they're counted as unemployed, whether they've got any benefits or not. But of course, if they haven't looked for work in the last 3 weeks, they've become discouraged, or for example, they're married and they haven't looked in the last 3 weeks, then they're not counted as unemployed. But of course, what governments do is they always choose the statistic which suits their story. So I didn't realise that they've decided to measure it by people on JSA again, because we stopped doing that years ago, because of course there were something like 20 or 30 changes during the last Conservative government in who was entitled to JSA or unemployment benefit. And of course every time you change it, the figure is not comparable with the previous figure.
And how's the work programme going? Because there's a lot of pressure on these private work programme providers to get the people off of those figures, isn't there? For example, somebody who maybe does a little bit of gardening, maybe once or twice a week, is encouraged to say, well, actually now you're self-employed, even though of course they're not actually earning anywhere near enough to make a proper wage, and they're shifted from JSA onto working tax credits. They're allowed to do that for a year, in which case HMRC will start saying to them, hang on a minute, you're not really self-employed, are you? You're taking too many tax credits. But then, after that year, of course, the work programme provider gets their bonus, their £15,000 or whatever it is, to get a long-term unemployed person off of the JSA, and then they have to go back onto JSA. So there is a little bit of massaging of these figures going on.
Yes, there is. And another factor, of course, is all the people employed in the work programme are substituting for people who used to be employed by Job Centre Plus or whatever it is, you know. So in actual fact, by doing that, in one full swoop, the government has cut public expenditure, inverted commas, or cut the number of people employed in the public sector and substituted people in the private sector, and that counts as job creation as well. But it seems to me that none of these work programme providers are going to reach their targets. So they're all going to go bankrupt because they won't be paid because they won't have reached the targets that were set.
I mean, there
and
are
that
even,
will be chaos.
There are even cases of people who are selling knickknacks on eBay and selling things at car boot fairs actually being moved off of JSA onto the working tax credit system. That, you know, they're not real jobs, are they?
No, they're not. And lots of people who are in proper jobs at Sainsbury's and so on are also on working tax credit, so they're also taking handouts from the taxpayer, if that's what we want to call it. But of course the whole thing is actually a lot of smoke and mirrors and propaganda. The economy is dead in the water, and of course capitalist economies don't just stagnate. Then there's a real danger of a panic setting in at any moment.
Okay, on to one of the extra things that we're going to be having to pay for soon, and that is George Ferguson's Olive Branch over the residence parking. Now, this is one of the big issues in the city, right across the city now, people wondering and worrying about how much they're going to have to be paying to park their car outside their front door. Of course, another completely new bill that people have never had to pay before, the pile and all the rest. Rob, what's your thoughts about the Mayor's approach to the residence parking schemes?
The Mayor's approach has been a bit scattershot. We haven't really got a proper consultation period going on, and as a result, a lot of the emphasis is being placed on the councillors, and I agree this is something we maybe should be doing, to organise meetings so that people can actually air their views. A lot of people feel like they haven't been listened to at all on this. And I went to a meeting on Wednesday in St Paul's that was called at very short notice, because there's been such tight time constraints on this process, and which most people there were completely against the scheme. They didn't want it at all. As a Green, in principle, I'm in favour of the residence parking schemes, because I do think that they do remove some of the commuter traffic and do contribute to a better environment, and do cut congestion and pollution and those kind of things. But I don't think the process has been done effectively. George needs to sort of start listening a bit more and start actually consulting the people properly.
Well, I mean, isn't the whole point, one of the reasons he was elected, is just to get on with this, because people are fed up with it taking so long.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, strategically, he has to get this done. But there's a difference between getting something done and getting it done without any kind of public consultation at all.
Why is St Paul's a special case?
It's not a special case. I think there's a lot of areas that don't want the don't want the scheme.
Well, okay, there are some that do. You know, the common sense approach is just to get on with those, isn't it? And then maybe take a little bit more time, do some more consultation over the places that don't actually want it, in order to accommodate people's various concerns about the scheme.
I do accept that. But I think also you will end up with cars parking in a neighbouring area, and there is that temptation. But at the same time, I think people haven't been it hasn't been explained to people properly how this works and why it actually will benefit them.
Well, go on then.
Okay, well, I think actually it will drastically reduce the number of cars that are coming into Bristol to park, actually. And we have, you know, over the last 10 years, from South Gloucestershire, from North Somerset, from Baines, we've had actually an increase in the number of cars coming into Bristol. And if we can
I mean, have you been on the train recently, the commuting time? They're absolutely jam-packed. The buses, if they're not packed to the gunnels, are unreliable. So why shouldn't people use their cars?
Well, they can use their cars if they want. They'll just have to find somewhere.
I mean, isn't there a carrot approach rather than a stick approach? This sounds to me like you're saying, well, look, you know, we actually don't care that the public transport is so appalling. We're going to force you to use it anyway.
I don't think it's either or. I mean, you've got to get the public transport right, but at the same time, there has got to be some way of dissuading people from using their cars and actually get them onto the public transport, because I don't think that there's actually that incentive at the moment. And I do think that is something we need to encourage.
Well, the incentive is if the public transport's working, if it's reasonably priced, and it actually turns up on time, and you get a seat. Now, that's not too much to ask, surely.
It's not too much to ask at all, but this is some nirvana for Bristol, isn't it? I mean, we've not got there yet, and I'm willing to countenance anything that will effectively push people onto the transport a bit more. And I know that might mean that they have to pay a lot of money. It's £4, you know, for a day rider on the first bus. But the other option is, you know, having a congested city where people don't actually feel like they're living in a place that is worth living in.
Well, I would have thought, actually, for a lot of people in St Paul's, so long as the council isn't just using it as a way to extort money from people for parking outside their own house, that they would actually welcome this, because people are rather fed up right across St Paul's of it being used as a commuter car park. So, I mean, what to just report back from your meeting you went to this week, because I imagine there was a few sparks flying there.
There were some sparks flying. So there was actually quite a number of people there who were saying, we have to sort this out somehow. And St Paul's actually had a couple of semi-consultations before now, so it's actually quite a good one to talk about. And yeah, people have acknowledged in that meeting, even those who are fundamentally against this as an idea, that there needs to be something done about parking, because they know that there's loads of people parking at Cabot Circus. The most radical suggestion I heard on the night, which I would completely subscribe to but I know can't happen realistically, is that Cabot Circus pays for the residents' parking, residents' places in St Paul's, because after all, after that huge behemoth of consumerist paradise was built, they haven't really given anything back to the community in St Paul's, and it's right next door. So I do think that actually the ideas that have been generated by some of the meetings that are happening, although there need to be more, and there will be more, are actually bringing some, you know, good ideas to the table, and people actually do want to contribute to this and want to find a way to do it, but there's just not been a mechanism for that.
Well, the olive branch offered by George Ferguson includes doubling the amount of time that people can park for free before they get their ticket, and also an additional consultation on the schemes in each area before they come into force. That's a little bit more real consultation, we hope. So you can also park free in pay and display bays for 30 minutes rather than 15 minutes under those. So at the moment they're only saying people can stay for 15 minutes before they have to then leave, otherwise they get a ticket. But now George is saying, well, we'll let you stay for 30 minutes. Now, I mean, the trouble is, this isn't very much use for somebody who's, say, a plumber or whatever, who's going in. We were discussing this last week. A plumber or electrician, someone that's going into service, someone's washing machine, whatever, they will need probably about an hour. And it's those kinds of people who are going to be hit by this. Also, of course, businesses. There's a car firm that's threatening to pull out the city because they're saying they've only got two spaces. They have customers coming, you know, hour after hour, probably something like 30 or 40 customers, plus they've got their own staff need somewhere to park.
That's exactly the kind of point that needs to be made, and we need to find a solution to that. And that's the point that I'm making, I guess, is that we actually haven't had a mechanism to feed that in. We've now got the extent of it is a page on the Bristol City Council website, on the Ask Bristol page, that people can feed into. But what about all the people who haven't got internet access? You know, there's a lot of people in the city who still don't use the internet. So I guess what I'm asking is, how do we get all those ideas and take them on board? And I completely agree that we need to find a way that people can actually visit there. I mean, it's things like, you know, people have sick relatives that need to visit, you know. I mean, at the end of the day, you need to do that in a car often. So there needs to be a flexibility to the scheme that that's taken into account. And I'm going to try and represent that on Tuesday in the full council meeting when I make a speech about this and say, you know, there's so many different issues that just haven't been considered and built into the scheme. So, yeah.
Well, George Ferguson is saying, I have never been rigid on any of the application of it, that is the registered parking zones. The only thing I'm sticking my heels in is about the parameters of the outer zones. These are adjustments or improvements. I was always expecting to make improvements to the scheme. Martin, I mean, it is parking. To a certain extent, it's a bit boring, but actually, it's not, is it? It's right outside people's doors. I mean, you know, people want to park their car there.
Well, yes, I mean, I'm glad I'm not actually elected to have to deal with all of the problems that this is bringing up. I mean, I tend to agree with Rob. In the long run, we really need to think about transport in a holistic way. In the short run, if you don't listen to people and carry them with you, you clearly don't achieve anything. You can't reform things from the top down. You've got under, you know, it seems to me that everybody seems to be talking to each other. That's the best thing to do for the moment, isn't it?
What about St. Paul's, though? Because this is the sticky one, isn't it? People actually don't have the money to pay to put their car outside their own home, and yet they're being told they're going to have to.
Well, you could have, obviously, one thing you could say is that if you're on benefits of any kind, you get a free pass.
What about that, Rob? Is that on the cards?
There's a couple of things we were thinking about. Means testing is an option, but that, actually, we've looked into that.
That's going to cost money more, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, that's the issue. I mean, that's the issue.
I mean, surely it wouldn't cost anything if all you could say is, you know, you can prove that you're claiming benefits. I mean, because they've already been means tested to do that. So
that's,
I mean,
that's one way, you know, that's one suggestion. I'll try and make that point on Tuesday. I know that a lot of people in St. Paul's are... It is the cost issue for them. It's, you know, that's what...
I mean, we've seen this week, for example, another inquiry into the big six energy companies questioning their price-fixing monopoly. You know, people are so busy paying inflated prices for gas and electricity. This is just another headache. Anyway, Marina Morris joins us now. Marina, what have you got for us this week?
Hello. Our school are failing to challenge the brightest pupils, warns a new Ofsted report. A culture of low expectation means many of England's more able pupils are failing to gain top GCSE grades. The chief inspector of school, Michael Wilshaw, said it is an issue of national concern. He's 100% right. Schools are failing, not children. They fail to create the values and aspirations of how to be successful and competitive. The key to motivation is not external. Pupils have to be motivated within themselves to be passionate towards their life tenure. Children are not born with skills like this. They need to learn them. This is a valuable part of modern school and family environment. Brighter children's potential is underdeveloped by a failure to raise aspirations. Some teachers lack perception of how enthusiasm works. Mediocrity for all becomes a target. We need teachers to create a culture and atmosphere for aspiration and achievement. It is not only what you say, but how you say it. The government approach seems to be the pull motivation. Work harder, more exams and tests, longer school days, shorter summer holidays. These can be dangerous and threaten pupils in the long term, causing constant stress and sometimes mental problems. Some children achieve higher academic levels at a cost to their health. A million British children, 1 in 10, aged between 5 and 16, are estimated to be mentally ill. Encouraging, not over-pressurizing, is the key. The chief inspector of school said to the BBC, the key to success is having high expectation of all children and intervening the moment any of them showed signs of falling behind. He also emphasized the extremely important role of the family. Parents have a big influence of children. Home background is a significant indicator of future progress. The educational research shows that the children who do best at school talk regularly and positively with their parents. 150,000 children in England are home educated. Parents of these children set a personalized learning program. We faced the culture of low expectation. What would it mean to have a culture of high expectations?
Well, I'm going to put that straight away to you, Rob, especially since you used to work in schools as a teaching assistant. What are your thoughts about what Marina's saying there, and also Michael Gove's plans announced this week to overhaul GCSEs, really, you know, basically completely changing the way we do our O-level, or basic O-level system now?
I think that, I mean, I don't really know where to start with the education system, because for me, it does come down to
an attack, really, on the sense that public education is something that needs to be provided. I feel like the tiering of education is becoming more heavy, and even in Bristol, I think we're finding that more and more schools are becoming academies. We're finding that it's much more difficult.
Well, it's much more difficult to talk. You're sitting in an academy now, so you better be careful.
I should be careful. Yeah.
But I mean, what's your thoughts on if there's anything wrong with an academy? What is wrong with an academy?
I don't think that we should be using the education system for we shouldn't be allowing people to use the education system to finance something. I think actually it should be done from central government. I do think it's something that we should find ways of funding in a public way. I think the state we're in, though, I mean, we've got to be realistic about what we can do right now. The state we're in Bristol is that we've got, you know, more academies opening, not opening exactly, and more free schools, but more converting to academies. And that means that we've got to find a way to actually engage people from the different spheres now, because I think all these different tiers of education, they aren't talking to each other, and we need to find a way of doing that. My own experience of the classroom, it just shows me that what students need is they need adult supervision. They need people who are actually willing to listen to their concerns and get alongside them. And there isn't enough funding actually in more classroom assistance, more people who actually can help those who are struggling. I think that's not going to come about necessarily by tiering the system, and I think people will start to see each other as different.
Well, I mean,
based on
what Gove's proposing is actually subject by subject. One of the things that Marina very importantly picked up on there is that there's questions over the whole idea of the long summer holiday and that might be shortened. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I do think, I mean, when I was in the States, actually, they have a very long holiday there. They have three months off, but I don't think that. I think that's a really good thing, actually. That actually having all that time off is quite good. I mean, it's different because obviously they get a very hot summer, and it's different from the UK. But I do think that actually we do insist on kids being in school too much. Actually, I think that there should be more time for them to be away.
Okay,
from
one of the proposed changes to some of the proposed changes to the history curriculum in GCSE, a greater focus on British history, increasing from at least 25% of marks at the moment to a minimum of 40%, and requirement to show an understanding of chronology. Also in history, an in-depth study of one period of British history from either medieval, early modern or modern periods, a minimum of 25% of marks for wider world history, more emphasis on longer essay style answers in exams. So, you know, what are your thoughts about those proposals? History is a very important subject, quite clearly. How we understand how we got where we are is quite important for kids. What are your thoughts about those proposals that Gove's putting forward for the history curriculum?
I don't think it should just be British history. I think we've got to understand ourselves from what.
Well, they're saying 40%. It's going up from 25% to 40%.
And so therefore, I feel that actually we do learn actually mostly about British history. I mean, the cliche is that everyone, you know, talks about the Second World War as if it's the only thing they ever learn at school. But actually, the history curriculum needs to be broad and it needs to be deep, and it can't just focus on British history, because that's just going to stir up a sort of...
Well, no, they're saying 40% of the curriculum should be British history in a British school, rather than at the moment 25%. Martin, what are your thoughts about these changes?
Well, I mean, what can I say? Basically, a lot of this is to do with selection. And the grammar schools, they're saying that 60% of people who get A and A star at English and maths when they leave primary school, only 60% of them achieve A and A stars when they reach GCSE level. But in grammar schools, it's only 40%, and they select the people who've got A and A stars. So in actual fact, the comprehensive schools, which they're attacking, have a better record than the grammar schools, which Michael Gove went to when he was a lad. In Finland and in other Nordic countries, children don't go to school till they're seven, but they go to nursery school from when they're 3 years old. So they have four solid years of learning through play, and there is no attempt to teach reading to any child until the age of seven. Now, some children are very bright and they've learned to read anyway. Their parents may have taught them, nobody has been able to show that the Nordic system is in any way inferior to our system. And of course, they believe in learning through play. They do exactly what Marina was saying. They inspire people rather than make them learn by rote. quote. And frankly, Michael Gove has never taught in a classroom in the public or the private sector. Most of this stuff is rehashed stuff from his Billy Bunter books that he read when he was at school. And frankly, it's quite clear what the teaching profession have already said about this, is that completely opposed. And incidentally, if we're going to have one topic that's got to be studied about in modern history for about Britain, what about what happened in Kenya during the 1950s, where up to 200,000 people were tortured to death by British military personnel, as has just been proved in the High Court? Let's teach everybody in year four about that, shall we?
And what about the British history?
Well, indeed, if we're going to just cover the British Empire, we can do the Siege of Lucknow, we can do the Black Hole of Calcutta, we can really go to town on what Britain did in the world, and what they did in Kenya in the 1950s. Not in the 1850s and the Indian Mutiny, the 1950s. Because, of course, some of the people who were involved in that torture are still alive today. And I think we should be teaching our 14-year-olds that there are guys walking around in Britain who are involved in torture, because that's modern British history, which apparently we've got to learn.
Another thing in the news this week is the Prism. This is the revelation over the weekend during the Bilderberg conference. Rather nice that they had that bit of news, that maybe they didn't get through the wall of steel, but that the National Security Agency in the United States has been hoarding literally trillions and trillions of terabytes of data about all of our emails and all sorts of information that you thought was private. It isn't. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the announcement by William Hague in the House of Commons on Monday on this very topic.
When you see discussion in the media about this, people can get the impression there is a danger of a deep state out of control in some way. There is not that danger in the United Kingdom. So, of course, everyone is capable of error. But the protection of the citizens of this country provide from such error is very, very strong indeed.
Now, when the Americans are concerned about assaults on their citizens, they pursue this with an aggression that would make Lord Palmerston proud. Most obviously the extradition arrangements, for example. So has the Foreign Secretary made any representations to the American authorities about the protection of innocent British citizens' privacy under their FISA laws?
We know that the Foreign Secretary, the Home Secretary, and all his right honourable friends in the Conservative Party Cabinet want their own retention of large swathes of personal data, and he's prepared to compromise our civil liberties to obtain that. But does this episode not just demonstrate what could possibly go wrong if we had our own homegrown stupor charter?
Yes, many points there, and that was David Davis, the Tory MP, following up there, as well as one of the SNP MPs. Martin, the deep state out of control, has William Hague made any representations to the United States asking what's happening with our data? Because the answer is actually no, it doesn't seem like he has. He's saying there's nothing to see here, there is no problem.
Well, I mean, as we've known for years about Echelon, and of course the in the US in the past, they're not allowed to spy on their own people by the Constitution, and in Britain they're not supposed to spy on us without warrants by our Constitution. So of course what Menwith Hill in Yorkshire used to do is spy on American citizens on behalf of the Americans, and then because they're the British and they're allowed to, and vice versa. Well, so the CIA and MI6 basically swap. Well,
that's roles. Right. They've had these intelligence sharing agreements since 1946. Yeah. It used to be called UCUSA, UK-USA agreement. And what basically happens is you have a little MI6 office over in the National Security Agency, or a GCHQ office over in America. Yeah. And every time GCHQ want to spy on someone in Britain, they go and have a chat to their American office. And the American office gets the Americans to do it, and then the information is passed back here. So they're basically circumventing the law, aren't they? They're not going to a judge. They're not asking for a warrant. And it doesn't seem that William Hague thinks there's anything wrong.
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he, in the immortal words of Mandy Rice Davis? If you're telling, if you wanted to hide that there was a secret state doing terrible things, then that's what you'd say. And of course, this is the same William Hague who wants to arm the Al-Qaeda rebels in Syria and is banging on about it. No doubt that will be discussed in the County Fermanagh next week.
Rob, are you worried that your emails might be sitting on some massive database in America going back to the very first email you ever sent, called Prism?
Of course I am, yeah. I mean, I think it's an amazing story, and it just shows that we don't really have control over everything that we imagine that we do. We don't have control over the things that we're writing on Facebook and Twitter. And yeah, no, I mean, I was just brought home to be slightly recently by some training I did for the councillor role, and talking about data protection, you immediately realise that that actually, as public officials, you should have this accountability in place, so that if someone, you know, puts a Freedom of Information Act information request in, it immediately comes to light, and you know, our society doesn't seem to cohere with that. It doesn't seem to be. Yeah, it just seems to be something that we haven't got control over. So we need to hear a bit more from people from the opposite side of that, and who are willing to like delve into. And you know, journalists have done this for centuries. You know, delve into the secrets that are happening behind our backs.
But the fact of the matter is, Edward Snowden is facing a massive jail term in the United States. The US is now preparing a case to get him back to the US and to jail him, put him on trial and jail him.
Yeah. On that, I mean, that's the scandal of the whole thing, isn't it?
On that point, they're saying two things. They're saying, A, he's made it all up, and it's not really happening, in which case he isn't a traitor, and B, he is a traitor. Now, it can't be both. Either he's made it all up, and he's just, a fantasist, or he's a traitor. Which is it? Is he a fantasist or a traitor? I think he's a traitor in their terms. But in actual fact, of course, this is the problem with all of these secret state things. It all comes out in the end.
But he's really the latest, isn't he, in a line of people who've been trying to tell us, the public, just how powerful this deep state is. That is, we're talking about Julian Assange, who's still locked up in his embassy in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and also Bradley Manning, who's just gone on trial. Rob, I mean, it seems almost like we've got radical publishers seem to be the biggest enemies of the state. It seems a very strange state of affairs.
Radical publishers, sorry.
Well, that's essentially what these people are doing.
Oh,
they're publishing information, in other words, making it public.
Yeah.
Interesting, weird state of affairs. Why is it that they are public enemy number one?
Because they tell us stuff that we don't want to hear about, the way that our state is run. And the fact is that this has been done by, you know, I mean, it came to light for me, you know, during the last Labour government. I mean, without being partisan about it, I mean, that's just when it happened. You know, we got all these huge control orders and all these things that come in after terrorist attacks. But at the end of the day, we don't know what's happening behind the scenes, and we need to have a sense of what's going on there. We need to actually understand what is being asked of those people who are in, you know, in GCHQ or in the FBI or wherever they are. Some kind of understanding of what's going on. But when it comes to the US government, they shouldn't be looking at the UK government. They shouldn't be looking at our websites. Because the internet needs to be free. We need to actually have free access to it and use it without fear of reprisal for our words, which may or may not be construed in the correct way by the state. So, it's worrying.
Martin, what do you think is going to happen to Edward Snowden? Is he going to end up on trial like a victim of the court system?
He's gone to Hong Kong, because, of course, in Hong Kong they've got a Chinese administration.
Are there any countries in the world that will actually look after someone that whistleblower like this? The Icelandics
Russia have already suggested that they would look at any kind of asylum request that he put.
What about Iceland? Because they were saying as well that they wanted to be a haven for people like this. Maybe he was a bit more sensible booking a plane to Reykjavik rather than to Hong Kong.
The Americans have said anybody who flies him anywhere will be prosecuted, etc., etc. I think the important point for people to realise here is not just that they're snooping. It's what they're doing with the information when they've snooped.
But what are they doing with it then?
Well, I mean, as we were talking about at the Bilderberg conference last week, or I was talking about when I spoke, there is overwhelming evidence that NATO intelligence services have been involved in terrorism for the last 40 years. And I say that advisedly because Fernando Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, has just written a book about it, based on decades of work by the Italian police force, which, to my mind, shows without a shadow of a doubt that the Western intelligence services foment terrorism. Al-Qaeda, don't forget, was set up by MI6 under Operation Cyclone in the 1980s. And that's absolutely on the record. We all know that that was the case. MI6 were the lead agency in setting up Al-Qaeda under Operation Cyclone in the 1980s. Now, this is not just a question of people bugging phone calls. I don't mind being watched. I just wonder what the people who've got the information are doing with it, and who are they accountable to. And that's the problem we've got to face.
Now, that book, you're talking about the judge's book, Fernando Imposimato, was something about the state of unpunished massacres.
Yes, it's called La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, the Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. And it's basically, he's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, and he's investigated a lot of these massacres and attacks. The Bologna bombing, the bomb in Piazza Fontana in 1969. Daniel Ganser, the Swiss academic, has written a book about it, NATO's Secret Armies. There's been three parliamentary inquiries, one in Italy, one in Switzerland, and one in Belgium. And the conclusion of all of this is quite clear. Western intelligence services have been fomenting terrorism, not just not being very efficient at stopping it, they have been fomenting it. Now, that is what people have got to get through the head.
Well, so they haven't all been doing it, Martin. We have to cross our fingers and hope the guys with access to the PRISM information
are not the ones that are doing the terrorism. In Italy, the police have not been buying what the intelligence services have been telling them. Hence, they have got masses of information about the fact that the intelligence services have been carrying out these terrorist attacks. But the judge has written the book because he wants to tell the world at large, look, we've collected all this information about what NATO intelligence services are up to, but we can't arrest anybody because we're told that we can't. And, of course, he gave an interview last week in Italy where he said, well, I've got documents in my possession that link the Bilderberg Group to P2, which is the big Masonic lodge which was behind all the stuff that was going on in Italy. Now, actually, if you sit in a bar in northern Italy, lots of people know this. But if you sit in a bar in middle England, people go, oh, no, they don't think the government does things like that. But then they don't know a lot in Surrey, do they?
OK, on to another one. And court case and new job may clash for MP Fox. This is from the Bristol Post. A high-powered high-profile trial will renew the controversy over former Defence Secretary Liam Fox's relationship with his aide, Adam Werrity, just as the North Somerset MP is tipped to make a political comeback. Rumours have emerged that Dr Fox will be made chief whip in the next government reshuffle at the same time that a High Court judge has scheduled a trial over a defamation claim by the former Cabinet Minister. Dr Fox resigned from the Cabinet 20 months ago after it emerged during a meeting of a five-star hotel. Mr Werrity had given a card to a Dubai businessman which falsely suggests he held a formal Ministry of Defence position. Fox filed a lawsuit against the businessman, Harvey Balter, which claimed that he had gravely injured his reputation and exposed him to public scandal, contempt and odium in a television interview he gave during the furore. Now, Mr Justice Bean has cleared the case to come to trial. So this is Liam Fox, he's North Somerset Conservative MP, Martin.
Well, yes, I mean, this Werrity affair was very suspicious, wasn't it? I mean, he was going to meetings with Liam Fox when he was Defence Secretary, but he didn't have any security clearance. And the suspicion is that both of them are very, very close to the neocons in the US and the Israeli government. And that was why the civil servants raised the alarm. And we've got people here who are basically answerable to their friends in America and Israel, and they're sitting in our secret meetings.
Well, one of the things that Craig Murray, the former Uzbekistan ambassador, who's a very good blogger, by the way, if you want to look him up, he was suggesting was that actually Werrity his job was to put together a case to attack Iran. That wasn't an official MOD policy.
No, exactly, and that's why the civil servants raised the alarm and said, look, something's got to be done about this guy because he's turning up in our meetings and hasn't got a security clearance.
Anyway, Rob, what are your thoughts about Liam Fox? Do you think he should be given back his job in the cabinet? should he be a rising star in the Conservative coalition government, or do you think that this whole business of the scandal when he had to resign from being Defence Secretary should really preclude him from having some sort of major comeback?
I mean, I think it's damned if you did. If he comes back, it just makes the Tories look worse. If he stays where he is, then good, because that means he won't get any more publicity. I think that's basically my view on it. I don't agree with anything Liam Fox says. I think he always comes out in favour of everything that I want to speak against. In terms of the story, I think, you know, I've got no idea what the scandal really is about when it comes down to it. I mean, you've made some suggestions and they might be true.
Well, I mean, certainly Werrity didn't have... I mean, this was the major problem at the time, as he was going around pretending that he had some official MOD position, where actually he was just working for some charity and happened to be going around the world...
It wasn't even a charity. The Charity Commission has decided it wasn't a charity.
Basically going around holding hands with this guy around the world, pretending that he was some sort of government official when he wasn't.
The insinuation was it was a secret affair. Fair, wasn't it? But I don't think that's ever been proved either. I mean, for me, this is a story that just shows that we don't know what our elected officials are doing. A lot of the time, they're in league with vested interests. They don't have necessarily the best interests of the people they're supposed to represent at heart.
And a related story, battle lines have been drawn this week on the private sector role in defence. The Ministry of Defence is close to eliminating the black hole in its budget. Government has rattled the unions by pushing forward with plans to effectively privatise the body that supplies guns to the army and battleships to the navy. In a white paper on Monday, Defence Secretary Philip Hammond outlined his preferred option of bringing a private sector partner to help slash the cost of buying everything from missiles to radio systems. D Defence Equipment and Support, DE&S, has a budget of $14 billion, and Mr Hammond wants a big business to oversee the organisation and bring it within the commercial, bringing in some commercial nous to help get the most bullets and combat gear for the MOD's buck. Now, Rob, this is very much affecting us here in Bristol. That's where MOD procurement is based, and they're basically talking about privatising it. Now, we know that some of the companies in line to run it after privatisation are themselves defence manufacturers. Now, this is a little bit concerning that you might end up with BAE Systems involved in actually deciding on whether BAE Systems should get a massive defence contract.
Yeah, we need to get rid of the private companies and the influence. We need to get rid of the defence industry in this country. I mean, there are countries in the world who don't even have a standing army, and we've got huge resources that we need to put those people who are working on weapons of war, basically. We need to retrain them and get them working in the green economy, get them actually working on jobs that are actually going to make a sustainable country and make us actually able to, survive this century. Because at the end of the day, that's the emphasis we need to change, and it's a very stark choice before us. The specifics of that seem to me that we, again, are allowing private interests rather than public good to dictate public policy. And I just think, I mean, I've been active in campaigns against DESO, which then became, after Gordon Brown changed it, UKTI DSO, the government department that actually supports arms trade, sales to other regimes around the world. And the UK government is complicit in a lot of things that are happening around the world, and isn't the great peacemaker that we're led to believe by a lot of people in government.
Martin, services group Serco and the US company Bechtel, possibly in the running for taking over Abbey Wood, basically. And the unions are saying that Bob Rowling, Secretary for the Defence Sector at the Public and Commercial Services Union, told The Independent, "We're not impressed with this. Our members are not impressed that this defence procurement should be left to the private sector. This poses a big risk. We've got a workforce committed to maintaining standards for the front line, and we can't be certain that will still be the case within the private sector."
Well, I think the idea that you're going to save money by bringing the private sector into military procurement is ridiculous. Look at the Pentagon; a lot of policy is driven in the West by the interests of arms companies. It just is. Mm. Now, if we're going to have an arms industry, and I'm not a pacifist, at some point perhaps we do have to arm ourselves to defend ourselves, then that's got to be done by the public sector for the public benefit. If there's any hint of private interests involved in it, then it's A, wrong in principle, and B, also it leads to mess-ups like the SA-80 rifle, which was privatised halfway through its production and has turned into a piece of junk that the army would rather throw in the river. And that is largely due to the privatisation of the procurement process for that rifle. And I think people who are serving on the front line deserve better than that.
What about the influence that these big defence companies already have on foreign policy? Because
well,
that's a bit worrying, isn't it? If you've got defence industries not only deciding on the contracts, but also saying, well, actually, we don't have a war at the moment, we need to start a new one, because that just generates more profits.
I don't think it's that they want to start a war, but, for example, Saudi Arabia, which is one of the most repressive regimes in the world, has been supplied with massive amounts of weaponry from Bristol. And, of course, eventually a Saudi patriot might come along with a car bomb and make you understand what weaponry's all about.
Okay.
If you're really that bothered, you know.
Final Bristol story. Preferred developer, hooray, a finally named for Bristol's Carriage Works. This is on Stokes Croft, the notoriously terrible building. Rob, just tell us a bit about this quickly before the news.
Well, I was at the meeting, and basically Knightstone Housing have been named the preferred bidder for the Carriage Works on Westmoreland House, which, if you don't know it, is that sort of facade by, oh, I've forgotten his name, Godwin, that's it. The architect was Godwin on it, and this has been an absolute eyesore in Bristol for many, many years.
Come it's finally actually being done as a compulsory purchase or something?
It will be a compulsory purchase. There are a number of different stages it's going through. It's going through procurement, and it's going to take a while.
Ready for work in 2015, so still a little bit of a while to go. Anyway, Rob Telford, Green Councillor for Ashley, thanks very much for joining us. The Murdoch News now, afterwards, Bilderberg Bees and Legal Aid.
And on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.